is, and we believe that it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight we have a special guest visiting. I heard his story before at the Serenity House, Bill Hubbard. Made a big impact. He's got a real strong message. There's a little mirth in the madness there. So I hope everybody gets as much out of it as I got out of hearing the story the first time. And with that, I'll give you Bill.
What exactly is mirth? Is that good?
It's like
dead. Oh. Hello, I'm Bill Hubbard. I'm an alcoholic. And welcome especially to you guys. I hope after this you'll come back. And I want to thank all my buddies from Serenity House for coming. That means a lot. Before I got to AA, I didn't really have friends. Not like the ones I got today. The people that are here tonight and some more, I wouldn't be here without them. And that's not why I came to AA. I didn't come here looking for friends, and I didn't come here looking for a relationship with God. That's just sort of one of the blessings that's happened. And what's happened in my life is truly a miracle. I got sober on Christmas Eve. I got a big book that year for Christmas. In 2004. And kind of what led up to that was a trip I went on to get a Christmas tree 15 minutes up the road. And I left on December 14th. I got back on Christmas Eve. And my son was so proud. I mean, he said, Dad, can I go with you to pick it out? I said, no, son, I'm going to surprise you with the biggest tree in the forest. And I did get it within about 15 minutes. And in the following days, it had caught on fire a few times from cigarettes coming out of the truck. And somebody tried to steal it in a hotel parking lot. And it was pretty bad. It seemed very normal at the time. But I never thought there'd be a day where I'd be grateful that that happened. And I'm grateful that that happened today, because AA really works. And it's given me a life that I never thought was possible. So, any questions? That's about all I got. I was born in 1966, right here in Atlanta. From a good family. You know, my family wasn't troubled. My dad didn't beat me. My brother and sister didn't hate me. My parents never fought, at least as far as we knew. I do think they got in the car and left the house a few times to discuss things, you know, but it was almost like the Cleavers, you know. We weren't rich, but we never wanted really for nothing. Lots of love in my house. I'm the youngest of three. I still have a relationship with everybody in my family. Everybody's local, all in the Atlanta area. We all get along. Somehow they found it in their hearts to forgive me. I'm really the only one in my family that's gone down this path. It left a lot of loved ones scratching their heads. You know, what's wrong with Bill? And the list of things that weren't wrong with me was much easier to recite. You know, it was pretty weird. But like I said, growing up was fine. Played Little League, did all that stuff, went on vacations, but I was always the most comfortable in my room, away from everybody. Because it always seemed like everybody was so good, and I was always trying to act the role just to fit in under my own roof, you know. And that was my stuff. It wasn't anything people were doing to me. It was just fear, you know. I've always been in fear. But we moved up to Ohio when I was two. Spent about 8 years up there, long enough to become a Buckeye fan. Bruh. And got back here when I was 10. Never did very well in school. I was diagnosed ADD real early. Mom used to play with a Ritalin dose, which is probably why I'm here. It's all Mom's fault. A lot of behavioral issues. A lot of little therapists that made me jump on a trampoline for 10 minutes, then try to catch a rubber ball and a Dixie cup. And I don't know what all that was about. I know it cost somebody a fortune, though. And, you know, none of that worked. I still became an alcoholic. And even, you know, before I got here, I started trying to catch the ball in the cup and still wanted to drink. But through elementary school, just bad grades, wrong friends. And that's when I really started to feel insignificant in my house. My brother had these friends that were amazing, you know. My parents loved them. When they came to visit, they never stole anything. they were always on the good baseball team, and I was always on the bad one. And but the guys I started hanging around with, we all snuck cigarettes from our parents and filled little butter dishes full of every different kind of liquor, just enough of everything so you couldn't tell it was missing, and sneaking out in the woods and drinking and throwing up and drinking and throwing up, thinking this is awesome. Then we started inhaling cigarettes and throwing up from that, so we kept doing that. And it's kind of funny now. I thought I got away with so much, you know. I didn't really get away with a lot. I think there were certain things my parents were willing to address, and certain things that they weren't. And being a parent now, I really can't see how I ever got away with anything. Because my kid's never going to get away with nothing. I've done all that, and it's the coolest thing in the world is to know what he's thinking, you know, and to know what to count. You know, you keep count of certain things around the house. But in high school, I guess I had my first real bout with trouble and alcohol. And in 10th grade, I made the decision to run off with some friends. And it was during exams. They gave us, for some reason, 3 classes a day and a 2-hour lunch. And we spent the 2 hours drinking liquor. A lot of it, taking shots, and I'd never done that before. But remember, it was a big bottle. It was Jack Daniels, and we were chasing it with peppermint schnapps. I wasn't able to hold it down. I was in the middle of a graphic arts exam, and the teacher told us to write down what we thought we deserved in the class, and I remember getting all the way to, I deserve a B. And then I became intimate with half the people in the room as I threw up all over them. And they drug me down the hall into the principal's bathroom and just stuffed me there until my mom showed up. And to this day, I've never seen her look like that again. The only thing, that was a complete blackout. I found out a lot once they let me back into that school, some of the things that happened that were pretty funny, but nobody had to remind me of was that door opening up and my loving mother, who tried so many different things to do with me to settle me down and to make me comfortable. Never seen anybody look that disgusted in my life, and I'll never forget that look. And I was talking about it with her the other... Oh, careful, guys. Angry Jay's here. He's liable to snap. I'll never forget the face she made. And that's all I remember of that. She apparently, as the story goes, took me home, threw me in the shower, and threw me in bed. The next thing I remember was the door coming off the hinges to my bedroom when Dad got home. And I remember it being dark out, and he said, "Are you sober?" I said, "Yes." He said, "How would you know?" And slammed the door. And it sucked. You know, I'll never forget it. But I was drinking alcoholically from the beginning. I'm pretty sure I was an alcoholic before I ever took a drink. You know, what I've learned in AA, alcohol is a symptom. You know, it's my thinking that's my real problem. my character defects that are my real problem. Fear of everything in the world is my real problem. And for a long time, drinking made that okay. I became the social butterfly. There was that one beer where you could play really good pool, you know. And the way I was drinking, I could get through about a half a game of pool pretty good, you know, because that one beer didn't last very long. You know, I went from there straight to oblivion. And all of a sudden, you're not funny anymore. You're annoying. And, you're not cute anymore. You're disgusting. And all in the same night. It's amazing. But and as a disclaimer, and out of respect for AA, I am an alcoholic first and foremost. My story does cover some outside issues that I guess assisted in getting me here. Because I was able to stop drinking. I got several DUIs. I joined the service. I was in the Air Force, and military intelligence decided I would be better off in Germany. There's hardly any drinking going on in Germany, so it was a perfect place for me. You know, when somebody dies, they set up a beer tent. You know, and somebody's born, they set up a beer tent. Airplane lands, beer tent. And it was all very accepted there, you know. I got in trouble on base. They say in AA, nobody can diagnose you an alcoholic, and nobody told the government that. Because they have absolutely no problem diagnosing you an alcoholic. And the way they do it, you have to fill out a questionnaire. Have you ever done anything you regretted while drinking? No. Can you drink more now than you could when you first started? No. You're an alcoholic. That's where I got my first AA meeting. It was 1986. And I remember thinking, these poor bastards in here. I bet some of them are really alcoholics, you know. And I'll do what I can for them while I'm here. But as soon as my slip's signed, I'm out. And they're on their own. And I walk around trying to counsel people. You know, you just need more willpower. Just stop after, you know, two. And I found out later in life that doesn't work. But I got transferred from Germany to New Mexico, and they don't tolerate the kind of drinking here that they did over there. And nobody told me that. My first night in New Mexico was on Columbus Day, so the base was closed, and I stayed in a Motel 6. I went to a bar that was about 200 feet from the Motel 6. I drove there, and and I met a guy there that was stationed in New Mexico, and he had been, or stationed in Germany with me, and he'd been transferred to New Mexico. So I hooked up with him, and we caught up on old times, man, and it was awesome. There's one road that runs through Alamogordo, New Mexico. It's Highway 10, and if you pull out of that bar, you want to go left. I went right. And after about 30 miles, and I realized, you know, I am going the wrong way. I mean, the mountains started getting closer, and I was in the middle of the White Sands Desert there. So I turned around and pulled into a convenience store to ask for directions. Again, there's one road. Do I want to keep going? Will I eventually? They said, no, you're going the wrong way. And I bought a gallon of milk. I don't know why. And I turned around, and I came through the parking lot in a hurry because I had to get back to that Motel 6. And as my luck would have it, that particular convenience store had been robbed like 6 times that month. So right across the little parking lot, there was these bushes and about 30 cops in them waiting for the robbers. So they saw me leave like that, and they decided to dispatch two of the guys on the stakeout to come talk to me, and it probably took 5 or 6 miles to realize I was getting pulled over. I remember the song I was listening to, and I see these two cops coming the other way on 10, and they were hauling ass, man. I thought, somebody's going to get it. And then they came over into my lane. And then I looked in the rear view, and I saw the other four. I'm like, hey, this is coincidental. Whoever they're getting is right where I am. And eventually they got me over to the side of the road, and I just never had good luck drinking. I mean, the guy that finally came up to the door said, you know, if you would have just pulled over, we could have probably talked this out. I'm sure that would have happened. But Holloman Air Force Base had the highest DUI rate, divorce rate, and suicide rate of any military installation. So they started a program. If the base goes 30 days without a DUI, they'll have a wing down day, which what that was just a day off. Nobody had to go to work. I got there on day 29, and it was the closest they'd been in 4 years. I was popular. But I tried to keep it quiet. I tried to handle it like a civilian. I only gave them my Georgia driver's license. I didn't give them a military ID. The haircut might have given it away. But for about 5 days, I was really stewing. I thought, this is going to work. I haven't heard from the base yet. You know, I'll do whatever the town of Alamogordo wants to do, and the military is none the wiser. And I showed up to court, and they said, Hubbard, right here, report to your area defense counsel, which is the lawyers at Holloman Air Force Base. So the cat was out of the bag. So the first thing I had to do after that is go report to my shop chief, who was a really high-ranking guy. He was a senior master sergeant, which is like my arm's not long enough for all his stripes. He was like God. And just to make matters worse, his daughter was run over by a drunk driver and killed 4 months before I got there. And it was the lowest of the low, man. I mean, he's telling me about this story. He says she was drugged 400 feet under the car. I'm like, well, it wasn't me, man. I mean, I didn't hit anybody, you know. It was terrible. But I didn't feel anything for that guy at the time, you know. That wasn't my problem. You know, I'm not out doing that. I was right in my lane when they pulled me over, you know. I'm not one of those guys, and yet. And they sentenced me to all kinds of AA meetings there after being at them in Germany, and they were the same, you know, these people talking about God and yada, 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 you know. I always believed in God. I just didn't think I was eligible for what God does. Thought it was great what he did with fish and antlers and Christians, you know. It was beautiful. And I never had anything against people that were into that, other than the people that tried to force it on me, you know. You need God. That pushes me farther back, you know. But I got out of the service, got another DUI. I've had five total. Nothing ever really clicked that there might be an issue. I just thought it was luck, you know. And I said, that's it, I'm going to stop drinking. And I did. You know, I stopped drinking for probably 9 years. The only time I drank was when my wife went out of town. So that counts as stopped drinking. And it took a whole lot of pot and a whole lot of cocaine, but I did not drink. And I'm telling you, if you only have a drinking problem, cocaine's a real good way to get off of it. You get too paranoid to leave the room you're in, you know? And then you get too paranoid to leave the closet you're in. And I almost dehydrated. I wouldn't even drink water. I mean, so this is it. I've arrived, man. This is how I want to feel. You know, I feel good. My wife was the perfect drinking companion. She, when we drank together, we knew drinking was a bad thing. We were kind of like, you remember that cartoon where the coyote and the sheepdog clock in and they blow it out, and then at the end of the day they clock out, Night Sam, Night Ralph, you know. That was us. As soon as we started drinking, first couple beers it was great, honey, I love you. Second couple of beers, honey, I am going to rip your head off. Why? You're sitting there. Good enough. And we've been through a lot. We quit drinking together. She picked me up out of rehab once, and We drove straight to Douglasville and tied one last one on. It's just a nightmare, man. It still wasn't clicking that there wasn't anything I could do inside my power to stop doing what I was doing. I just couldn't stop. But I didn't know I couldn't stop. I figured I just hadn't made up my mind to do it yet. Things got worse and worse and worse. We had a son in 1996, great little kid. The timing on that was way off, wasn't it? God, I hope he never hears that. Having a son was a good part. We put him in daycare for, I think, one day, and Lori picked him up, and his diaper was hanging off of his ankle, and all these other kids are climbing up curtains, and she said, "Not our son," you know. And then we found some private daycare for him that she just watched four or five kids, and then after that, they said, "Not your son," you know. He's got a set of pipes on him, man. That kid was loud, and he loves to cry, you know, cry loud. I mean, he was scaring kids. Lori would call to check on him, and the ladies with him, you know, and she just hears, "Wah!" You know, and we thought, he misses us, you know. We're so good to him. We put him in front of a TV and hang out in the garage, you know. It was not right. So she said, "I'm not working during the day anymore. I'm going to take a night job." So I worked all day. She stayed home with Adam. I got home, she went to work, and then my shift with Adam started, and so did a little meth dependency thing I had going, so I could stay up for the kid, and didn't want to miss nothing, and that was another thing that just seemed so fitting, you know. I was tired, I worked hard, I got to watch a kid, need a little help, daddy's a little helper, I guess, but that kind of spun out, too. That didn't work out for me. I went into the bathroom. It's about 5 o'clock in the evening. She was at work. Adam was fine where he was. And I went in the bathroom to do this little bump. And while I was in there, I decided I'd prepare all the rest of the bumps that I would need. And I don't know if you've ever done that kind of stuff, but you lose track of time, you know. When I came out of there, my kid was gone. And I'm looking all over the house for him, and then I see the sliding door open, and he was one. And our backyard kind of goes out, and there's a bank that goes all the way down. And I started freaking out at that point, man. But the way I was freaking out isn't probably how normal people should. I'm thinking, Lori's going to kill me. I lost our kid. Lori is going to be so mad, you know. It was about me. It's always about me. I'm going to be in trouble for losing our kid. Didn't really dawn on me that my little one-year-old might be in trouble somewhere, you know, lost. It was like, God, I'm going to get it. And finally found him. He had somehow made it down the bank, around the houses, and then coming back up the sidewalk, again with his diaper around his ankle. So I quit being mad at the daycare for that. Turns out he was doing that. But just crying his little eyes out, you know. Thank God he had learned to walk by then, you know, so he wouldn't have had to crawl. But, you know, I ran out and I got him and I grabbed him and I ran in the house. And then I'm looking around to make sure nobody saw him, you know. And I put him back in his crib and taped together all the rungs that he broke through to get out of there. And I was crying my eyes out, man, and I was hugging him, and I said, "Man, I love you," and he was crying, and he finally calmed down. I said, "I'll never do it to you again. I'm going to change, man. That's it. That's the thing, you know. I want to be a dad. I want to be like my dad. My dad was awesome. My dad never did any of that stuff, you know, and I can't picture my dad doing any of that stuff." And I swore to him, and I prayed over him. You know, if there is a God, listen to me now. I never want to be this guy. And I made it about 15 minutes. That's it, you know. So I was pretty sure God wasn't going to do anything for me, you know. I put all my heart and effort into that prayer, man. And I meant it. And using again. And kind of got, for some reason, it wasn't that bad not doing that stuff anymore. I went back to drinking a little more and started my own business. Seems my work. ethics and the hours I wanted to work didn't exactly coincide with most employers. I started as a landscape company. We did really well to a point. I'm not responsible enough to own a business. I'm not diligent enough to do the books. I could go sell the job. I could get the job done. And then I felt rich. And I started spending money in some bad places, doing some bad stuff, and wound up with a whole nother addiction. You know, seemed like everything I ever did to change the way I feel, I could never get enough of. I don't care what it is. It's there's a pattern. It wasn't quite apparent to me yet, but I started smoking crack, and that took everything in a hurry. You know, and I thank God for that. That got me to where I was going real quick. I wasn't going out selling any more work. I wasn't paying my guys. They hung in there as long as they could, but it got bad. It got bad between me and my wife. We separated, and you know, at the time that was like a dream come true for me. You know, no, it really was. It's no more 2-hour trips to get a gallon of milk. I didn't have to go get the milk. You know, it was days on end, no sleep, cheap hotels, hanging out in places I wasn't supposed to be, doing things I shouldn't have done, things that I today wouldn't do, you know. But I know that's part of my makeup, man. I know what's waiting for me. And I wound up getting arrested. I had both pockets full, and showed up at somebody's hotel and knocked on the door, and Six of Roswell's Finest were there. Again, my luck, they were serving a warrant on somebody who wasn't me, and apparently they said, hey, we can tip you off to something. He'll be here in about a half an hour. And I was, and they sent me to Fulton County Jail. There was a loaded gun and car keys and a lot of narcotics involved, and Roswell informed me that Roswell couldn't handle a case like that with the gun and the car and the amount. That goes straight to the federal courts, and that's mandatory 20 years. You'll do 98% of it. They kind of run you through federal court, and I was, in a way, man, I was kind of relieved, because at that point, it was out of control. Even I didn't like me, you know. The drinking wasn't working anymore. It wasn't making me feel any better. The drugs weren't making me feel any better. Life sucked, man. I mean, it was horrible. And went to jail, and Fulton County said, if you want to cooperate, we can probably work something out with you. And I'd love to say, no, I'm not the kind of guy that's going to tattle. But I sang like a canary. I mean, it's kind of, I mean, you know, these slow. Where they lived, I gave them cell phone numbers, and something else that might interest your officer. They steal stuff from Home Depot and sell it, you know. And that worked. They separated the gun, so no longer did it have to go to federal, and it was in Fulton County. And if you can haul it all in one tractor trailer in Fulton County, you're small potatoes. So they did a first time offender pre-trial intervention thing with me. I had to go to 15 weeks of counseling. That still cracks me up. The counseling was on Bankhead Highway, which that didn't make any sense to me. But at that point, my wife had already gotten into AA. She started going to the Serenity House. She met some people there that listened to her. And apparently there was a lot to listen to, you know. She struggled a little bit, but she was on her own with a kid and no money coming in. And I did that to her, you know. She's worked all her life. When I had this company, We made enough that she could be a stay-at-home mom. That was our dream. We had a house, and I let it all blow up and left it in her lap. And when I got out of jail, she let me come home, and I went to a meeting that day, and I picked up a white chip, and thought it was going to be okay, you know. Then I got back to my truck where the police left it, and I went straight for where I knew they wouldn't look, and it was still there, and back out, you know. And I went in and out a pretty good bit. And she wasn't very far along in the program at the time. Her favorite thing was to catch me, you know. And for some reason, she thought I was lying. I don't know what that was all about. But, you know, laying awake in bed, wide awake until it seemed like a suitable time to leave the house, you know, so I could go do what I was doing. And one day, I don't know what happened. She gave up on me, which was, she lasted a lot longer than I would have liked. I would have never what I did to her if she did to me. There was one day I saw something happen to her. She caught me. I fell out of the ceiling. It literally fell out of the ceiling and landed right between us. And I'm like, man, how long's that been there? You know? When'd you start doing that stuff? And she got these big dog tears in her eyes, you know, and she just kind of looked at me, and I was already cowering, and I was afraid. She had a way of hitting me with whatever she found, so I started using lighter paraphernalia. But she wraps her arms around me. She tells me she loves me, and then she tells me it doesn't have to be this way, and then she tells me there's a solution. And that wasn't really what I was looking for, you know. Because when she jumped me about that stuff, it gave me the excuse I needed to go back out, you know. I'm not going to put my son through that volatile relationship that we have there because her temper is going to be the stand-up guy and I'm going to go, you know. And that changed everything, man. I saw that for the first time in our relationship, she had what I wanted, you know. And I've always been the chauvinist pig, I guess. You know, you're going to do things my way pretty much. And I envied her, man, and she was putting an awful lot into the program. She was at the Serenity House all the time, fluffing her kid around, working at Walmart all night long. And I came into AA again, and this time it was a little bit different. I really had the willingness. I got a sponsor. His name was Gene Evans, and he had all the time in the world for me. I've never felt so welcome. And I felt so bad because I couldn't do what he was asking me to do. I hadn't been badly mangled enough for some reason. And but I wanted it. I wanted what all these people in these meetings were talking about. They're laughing. They're joking. I was introduced to what they called at the time Angry Dan. That's him in the red shirt. And he was always the guy with the coffee and the big book, you know. And every time he shared, he read out of the big book. And that just killed me, man. I like the guys that were living on top of the buildings and taking their welfare check to the liquor store. And that's what I needed, you know. I was getting new tactics, I guess, you know, how to successfully live under a bridge because I was on my way. And I remember walking up and saying, so you're the one they call Happy Dan. And he says, you know, when you're ready to take this serious, then come talk to me. And I thought, what an asshole. I'll show you. And that's really what I thought. I thought, man, that's what I thought. You know, hey, he's a bunch of judging jerks, you know. That guy doesn't know how bad I'm hurting. He knew every bit how bad I was hurting. He's just not one to pinch me on the cheek and say, I love you, please come back. He told me like it was. And he put me on a little sawed-off New Yorker sponsor. His name was Ronnie. And Ronnie liked to collect sponsees that were really hard to get sober. And he usually tried to collect one from every career field. He needed a landscaper, a computer guy, a painter. And he always had a place we could do service work. Guy's a genius. He knows every word there is to know in the big book. me in the steps fast. He doesn't believe in taking our getting married. Is in the every time I my holier than AA wife, page 62. Every time I complained about anything, read page 62. Selfishness and self-centeredness. You stepped on the toes of your fellows and they're retaliating. All right. For a while, I thought, man, this guy doesn't know nothing about me. You know, I always brought a check home. I didn't know what this was. We got through the steps pretty quick. And it was beautiful. Power was in that I thought, I'm doing good here, you know. I'm getting, he's got his flagship sponsee now. And I hand it to him, and I'm proud. I'm patting myself on the back. So what do you think? And he throws it at me and goes, wrong! He was looking for one word. It wasn't drugs. It wasn't alcohol. It was thinking. He explained to me that I'm powerless over my thinking. I have no control over the thoughts that come into my head, you know. I drive by a certain part of town and I see a certain convenience store and my mind's off to the races. It's still that way. I haven't been to the Texaco in Sugar Hill and coming up on 4 years. Not that I can't, I just don't. You know, I'm not willing to. There's certain parts of town that do it to me. And he's right. I'm completely powerless over those thoughts that come into my mind when I get in certain places or when I get jealous about something or when I get angry about something or when I get scared of something. I think drinking might fix that. What I do have some power over today is what am I going to do with those thoughts? I started calling him, you know. Hey, I'm thinking about drinking. And to me, nothing could have been harder than to call another alcoholic. It's insanity, if nothing else, to be an alcoholic, to finally find another alcoholic that I could tell the truth to. And when I tried to lie to him, he said, you're lying. He knew already. Dan knew already. Everybody knew already. Amy knew. Amy hated me. Because she listened to Lori, and Lori was full of shit when she got to AA. All that stuff she said about her husband, no. She drove me to drink. I was scared to death to tell anybody in the program that I was thinking about drinking. I thought that made me a failure. And nobody can convince me. A guy with 36 years came up and said, you know, there's times when I think a drink might help. That's part of being an alcoholic. I'm always going to be an alcoholic. I'll never not be an alcoholic. I think whatever we do after death, I'll be an alcoholic there too. I hope to God that I am. Because that's the coolest thing I ever found out about myself, you know. I've never fit into anything before, you know. I fit into AA, man. I'm right at home in AA. I travel a lot with my job, and I'm an alcoholic there too. I can't check into a travel. My company doesn't put you up in a Ritz, man. We're like finding travel lodges or Days Inn, and those places are all too familiar to me. And I walk into them, and the same thing happens every time. It's that nauseousness, you know. And all the furniture seems to be the same. All the burn marks are in the same spots. All the mirrors are busted, you know. The Bibles have the middles cut out of them, where people were hiding stuff, you know. And today I find where the meetings are, you know. But we got through the steps pretty quick. We got to a third step. And I got on my knees and I did a third step with him, knowing that this wasn't going to happen. All the meetings I had heard leading up to this were, you know, when I got up from that third step, life was different. It was different. I felt this power flowing into me. I got up from that third step and went, damn, I knew it. Constitutionally incapable. You know, looked out the window, no bushes on fire. Ain't going to happen. He said, just hang in there. You know, he goes, you feel any better? I'm like, yeah, man, it's like I'm not even an alcoholic anymore. That third step's awesome stuff. And he goes, yeah, you're a liar. But you got to do the third one to get to the fourth one. And I did a four step. And I was pretty honest on it. All the stuff on my four step was easier to tell this guy than I felt like drinking for some reason, you know. Because if you knew him, he's way sicker than any of us will ever be. He's an awesome AA, I'll tell you that. But we did a fifth step and a sixth and seventh step, and it was probably a day or two after that. My step work revealed that it wasn't anger and pride that I wanted my big seven deadly sins. You know, I thought maybe that's probably my character defects, anger and pride. You know, a really cool guy, and turned out to be sloth. Apparently, I was too lazy to get mad, and so I got on my knees. We asked God to take away sloth, and I could never figure how that ranked in the top seven bad things. You know, sloth. And he says, "Just imagine if everybody were as lazy as you." You know. We'd still be pushing things around on square concrete wheels, I guess. But there was something happened, because the first 6 months of my sobriety, I told my wife that I can't have a job right now. I truly was unemployable, but I need to focus on my sobriety. So you go get like three jobs, and I got to get to meetings. If we're going to make this work, you got to support me. You know, I was playing it. And a couple days after I asked God to take away sloth, I wound up with a job. Which is a coincidence. I don't know if you know it or not, but there's lots of coincidences. Not really. There's none. But there was a strange feeling that the drink problem was gone. I didn't wake up feeling like that. It's just one day I realized, you know, it's been a couple days since I thought about drinking. It's been a couple days since I thought about using. I even told my wife the truth today. It was about something simple, you know, like, did you get the mail? Yes. But it was a start, you know, because I would lie about that. Did you get the mail? No. Just to stay sharp, you know. I don't want to accidentally be honest when I shouldn't. And things were better. I felt better. I felt like I'd never felt before. And there was an hour here, 2 hours there, all leading up to this. But I started making some amends. Everything was going so good, I fired that sponsor and I got another one. He's married. I'm married. And I needed somebody to kind of teach me how to practice these principles in my home. I think that's the hardest place in the world to work AA, is at home. I got all the time in the world for you people. You need something, call me. We'll get together. We'll talk about it. I'll come get you wherever you are. Thanks to AA. Thanks to God in my life. My wife just needs somebody to listen. I'm too busy, you know. Hey, you're working the same steps I am. You know, handle that with your sponsor, you know. And my problem was, I always thought she was telling me all these things going on in her life because she needed me to fix them. And I think that might have something to do with ego. And I started complaining to my sponsor. I'm like, man, I don't know what's wrong with her. And he says, well, you can put the lab coat and the stethoscope away and just try to listen. So I try to do that. And I do that better today than I did before. It's still the hardest place in the world for me to work AA is at home. I think it's something about the bump going into my driveway. It knocks all the spirituality off you, you know. But the blessing is, and she's still in the program and doing great, and the blessing is, if we're doing the same thing, if we're on the same page of the big book, so to speak, we're calling our sponsor every day, we're going to meetings, it's unbelievable. I never knew my wife until we got sober, and we've been together 18 years. I've been sober almost four. I don't know how we made it, and I can tell you, thanks to this program, I love her, you know. And not a day goes by that I'm not ashamed of the things I put her through. I put her through them. It wasn't like I was going home to this little Betty Angel or anything, you know. She's tough. She's a Yankee. But it was the ultimate dysfunctional relationship. You know, we stuck our kid in front of a DVD and hung out in the garage and got wrecked. And he would, like, open the door, "I'm hungry." "Just a minute, honey," you know. We were terrible. Not by choice. We had a disease, you know. It wasn't a choice. But the miracles that have happened in this program, I've got a job today that I used to sponsor the guy that owns this company. He's still a great friend. He gave me an opportunity. Somehow we were able to separate AA, friendship, and work. And I think it's where I'm supposed to be, you know. I never thought I'd have the kind of life I have today. I had a real hard time feeling like I deserved the life I had today. Because you always hear people, if I got what I deserved, I'd be dead. I'd be in jail. I'd be whatever. And things were going so good, so quick. I mean, like within the first year, you know. Just unbelievable things happening. Everything wasn't fixed. There was still a bankruptcy to file. There was still a car to lose. There was everything we'd worked so hard to build up, we were losing it all. But somehow it was okay. I kept praying, "God, let me be okay with whatever you're doing right now." And miracles would happen. $50 short of a power bill, you put an old jacket on and there's $50 in the pocket. And stuff I was doing, you generally didn't misplace money, especially $50, you know. That was a good 10 minutes worth. And it's a blessing. You know, the friends I have today are true friends. I love them. The relationship I have with my wife and son, there's probably a couple things I would change, but I know now that God's doing what he's doing. Something in those steps gave me a relationship with this God I was so afraid of. I was never afraid of burning in hell or none of that. That was just, that wasn't a fear. That just wasn't a big prayer. But today, every morning, I start out talking to God. Throughout the day, you know, it says in the book, when I'm in fear, I ask God to take away the fear and direct my attention toward what he'd have me be. And then it says that once we commence to outgrow fear. I actually do that. And today I'm interested in the answer that I might get. You know, it used to be God direct my attention toward what you'd have me be. Like the guy that's not going to go return the extra change they gave me. You know, I listen for the answers now, you know. God wants me to tell my wife I love her when that's the last thing I want to do. God wants me to answer the phone to that sponsee who really drives me up the wall. Working with other alcoholics is unbelievable. You know, just when I think I got it, a guy comes in and I see what he's got. And I know that's what I got. And I see how much pain he's in and how much torment he's going through. And that the only reason I don't feel like him today is because you guys taught me all about God. And I was never going to be the guy in AA talking about God. It's not my thing, you know. I was going to say, I work the steps and I work hard with a sponsor. It's God. God's the only reason I'm willing to do any of those 12 things. And there's a guy that I sponsor, you know, that had a tragedy in the middle of June. His 18-year-old daughter fell off of a mountain and died while climbing. And he had been sober about 3 years when that happened. Actually, it was right before his third year birthday. And, you know, I thought if there was ever a get out of AA free card, that's it. It's the loss of a child. You've got my blessing. Go drink, you know. He was in a meeting the next day. All these things to do. All these things to feel, and he's in a meeting the next day. And my first thought was, man, that guy is strong. And then my second thought that came real quick was, man, God's really strong. You know, that guy got here the same way I did. He's not programmed to go to a meeting at a time of tragedy. He's been at a meeting about every day. And I can't say he's thrilled with the prospect of God right now. Matter of fact, he's pretty bitter. He told me that he got on his knees just like he always does, and he asked God to take care of my family. And it just hit him one day. He says, why? Why do you bother even saying that? He ain't going to do it, you know? I think it's a perfectly justified resentment. But the fact is, God is so much bigger than me. As mad as this guy is, God still got him in a meeting. God is keeping him off the street. And God's okay with that. You know, I think you can only be mad at me for so long. And then screw you, you know. God's not that way. He's not that way. It says a higher power as we understand him. I guess everybody's got their own perception. That doesn't seem to matter to him either. You know, you can call me Steve so many times and I'll just blow you off. It's God's all that, you know. The only thing I can do is take myself out of that sunlight of the Spirit. And that's what I was talking to this guy about was, you know, there's a lot of conditions in the big book every time it says if, you know, if we want something to happen, we got to do what the book says to do. And I don't think that's God's love for me is conditional on whether I do this stuff or not. Whether I'm able to receive His love is conditional on whether I do that. It says we remove ourselves from the sunlight of the Spirit. It doesn't say God slams the door on us because we didn't do a thorough four-step, you know. It's just amazing. I have a pretty good feeling how it works now, and that's that I don't know. I know that if I do what's suggested to me and I do what's in the book, I get on the knees and ask for help, I'm probably going to be okay today. I think I'm going to do that stuff tomorrow, and I'll probably be okay tomorrow too, you know. I think God's got me right where He wants me today. And I wouldn't take back anything that happened in my life knowing that it would land me where I am today. You know, I would have done it all again, I guess, because I don't think I would have gotten here without it. And I wouldn't have known you guys without it. And I appreciate it. That's about all I got. Thanks.
It's a 5-minute intermission, then we'll get back in.
We'll let you finish in just a little bit. That was great, Bill. Thank you very much.